Hey everyone, welcome back. We're diving into some really fascinating territory today. You know, those crucial legal and financial concepts that can sometimes feel like a bit of a maze, especially when you're trying to make sense of it all in law school. But don't worry, that's exactly why we're here. Today, we're zeroing in on a case that really highlights the importance of clear communication when companies are talking about their future prospects. It's all about the fine print, the cautionary language, and how it can make or break a company's defense when investors claim they were misled.
That's right. We're going deep into the world of securities litigation, specifically focusing on the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, that's the PSLRA. And the case that's going to be our guide today is Asher v. Baxter International, Inc.
Yep, Asher v. Baxter. Decided back in 2005, this case really digs into the safe harbor provision within the PSLRA, the part of the law that's meant to give companies some breathing room when making forward-looking statements. But as we'll see, it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Not at all. And that's why this case is so instructive, especially for those of you who are thinking about careers in corporate law, securities litigation, or really any area where you might be dealing with publicly traded companies, because it really boils down to this. How much can companies spin a positive story without crossing the line into misleading investors? And how can they use those all-important cautionary statements to protect themselves?
Okay, so let's set the stage. For anyone who might not be familiar with them, who is Baxter International? What kind of business are they in?
Baxter International is a major player in the healthcare industry. They develop, manufacture, and market a wide range of medical products. Think intravenous solutions, drug delivery systems, renal therapies, that sort of thing. They're a global company with a big footprint, and they've been around for decades.
So back in late 2001 and early 2002, Baxter started making some pretty optimistic projections about their future financial performance, right? What were they saying? What kind of picture were they painting for investors?
Yeah, they were painting a pretty rosy picture. They were telling investors to expect some pretty healthy growth in the coming year. They were projecting that their revenue was going to increase in the low teens, and their earnings per share, or EPS, was going to jump even higher by the mid-teens. Plus, they were anticipating a strong operational cash flow, at least $500 million for the 2002 fiscal year.
That's pretty substantial projected growth. And these statements, these projections, they weren't just whispers in a back room, right? Where were they making these statements?
Oh no, these were very public pronouncements. Baxter included these projections in their formal filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. They were talking about them during their earnings calls with analysts, and they were putting out press releases touting this positive outlook. So this was definitely information that was readily available to investors in the market.
Okay, so they're out there publicly and repeatedly saying, hey, we're expecting a really good year. Sounds like a pretty standard thing for a company to do, right?
Yeah.
Trying to drum up enthusiasm, attract investors. So what happened? What went wrong?
Well, here's where things get interesting. Fast forward to July of 2002. Baxter announced their actual second quarter results, and let's just say they didn't quite live up to the hype. Those low teens and mid-teens growth figures they'd been touting? Yeah, not so much. Their actual performance fell quite a bit short of those projections.
Ouch. I imagine that didn't go over too well with investors.
You got it. The market reacted swiftly and negatively. Baxter's stock price took a nosedive. It plummeted from around $43,000 a share down to about $32 a share in a pretty short amount of time. That kind of sudden drop, that's a big deal. It wipes out a lot of shareholder value.
Right. It's not just a blip on the radar. That's a significant loss. So not surprisingly, some investors decided to cry foul. They filed a lawsuit. What was the basis of their claim? What were they alleging that Baxter had done wrong?
The investors' core argument was that those earlier optimistic projections that Baxter had been making weren't just inaccurate. They were actually false and misleading from the get-go.
Okay, so they weren't just saying, hey, you made a bad prediction. They were saying there was something more nefarious going on, that Baxter intentionally misled them.
That's exactly right. The investors claimed that Baxter knew, or at least should have known, about several problems within the company that were very likely to drag down their financial performance. But instead of disclosing these risks when they were out there making those rosy projections, they kept quiet about them.
What kind of problems were they talking about? What specifically did they claim Baxter was hiding?
They alleged that there were issues in a couple of Baxter's key divisions, their renal division and their biosciences division. They also pointed to problems related to some planned plant closures. And they claimed that Baxter wasn't adequately acknowledging the negative effects of economic instability, particularly in Latin America, which was a significant market for Baxter at the time.
So just to be clear, the investors weren't saying Baxter was obligated to have a crystal ball and predict the future perfectly. They were saying that Baxter had information, negative information, that would have been relevant to investors trying to assess the accuracy of those projections, and they failed to disclose it.
Precisely. The investors were arguing that these undisclosed risks, these issues that Baxter supposedly knew about but didn't share, made those optimistic projections materially misleading.
Okay, there's that term materially misleading again. We touched on it earlier, but it's a key concept in securities law, right? Can you remind us again what that means, legally speaking?
Sure. In the context of securities law, materially misleading means that the information that was omitted or the statement that was false was so significant that it would likely have influenced a reasonable investor's decision about whether to buy or sell the company's stock. In other words, it's information that could have actually moved the market if it had been disclosed.
Okay, so the investors sued, claiming that Baxter had made materially misleading statements, violating securities laws. What happened next? How did this case play out in court?
The case was initially heard in a federal district court. And the district court judge, well, they sided with Baxter. They actually dismissed the case pretty early on in the process.
So round one goes to Baxter. What was the district court's reasoning for dismissing the case? Was there legal justification?
The district court relied on the safe harbor provision that's built into the PSLRA. This safe harbor is specifically designed to protect companies from being sued over forward-looking statements, like the financial projections that Baxter had made, as long as certain conditions are met.
Okay, so the safe harbor provision was Baxter's defense, but the investors weren't ready to give up, right? They appealed the district court's decision. What happened at the appellate level?
That's right. They appealed the dismissal to the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. And this is where things take a turn. The Seventh Circuit actually reversed the district court's decision. They said, hold on, not so fast. There are some issues here that need to be looked at more closely. They sent the case back down to the lower court to proceed further.
Interesting. So the Seventh Circuit disagreed with the district court's interpretation of how this safe harbor should apply in Baxter's case. That brings us to the really crucial legal question at the heart of this appeal. What was the issue that the Seventh Circuit was grappling with?
The Seventh Circuit was essentially trying to figure out whether Baxter's forward-looking statements, those optimistic projections they had made, were actually entitled to protection under the PSLRA's safe harbor. And this was particularly tricky because of the investors' allegations that Baxter had failed to disclose some pretty significant negative factors that they allegedly knew about all along.
So was Baxter's use of cautionary language enough to get them off the hook? Or did they fail to adequately warn investors about those specific risks they were supposedly aware of? That was the dilemma for the Seventh Circuit.
That was the big question. The Seventh Circuit had to decide whether Baxter's warnings were sufficient in light of what they supposedly knew internally about those potential problems. It all boils down to the adequacy of those warnings. Were they meaningful enough?
Right. We keep coming back to this idea of meaningful cautionary language. That seems to be the crux of the matter. Let's break it down for our listeners. First of all, what's the purpose of the safe harbor provision in the first place? Why did Congress include it in the PSLRA?
Congress created the safe harbor with a specific goal in mind: to encourage companies to be more open and transparent about their future plans and prospects. They wanted companies to feel comfortable sharing their outlook with investors without being afraid of getting sued every time those predictions didn't pan out perfectly. It was all about trying to strike a balance. They wanted to protect companies from frivolous lawsuits while also ensuring that investors had access to the information they needed to make informed decisions.
Okay, so the idea was to encourage companies to be forward-looking, to share their vision for the future without being paralyzed by the fear of litigation. But as we're seeing in the Asher v. Baxter case, it's not an absolute shield. There are conditions, right? What does the company have to do to actually be protected by this safe harbor?
There are a few key requirements. First, the statement has to actually be forward-looking. It has to be a projection or a prediction about something that might happen in the future. This could include things like revenue forecasts, earnings estimates, plans for new products or acquisitions, that kind of thing. Then, and this is the part that's particularly relevant to our case today, the forward-looking statement has to be accompanied by meaningful cautionary language.
There's that phrase again, meaningful cautionary language. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Mm-hmm.
What does meaningful mean in this context? Is it just a matter of slapping a generic disclaimer on a statement and calling it a day?
That's a really important point, and this is where a lot of companies can get tripped up. Simply including some standard boilerplate language about general risks isn't going to cut it. The courts, and the Seventh Circuit was very clear about this in the Asher case, expect more than just vague warnings. Meaningful means that the cautionary language has to be specific and tailored to the actual risks that the company is aware of at the time they're making the projection. It's not enough to just say, hey, things might go wrong. You have to actually tell investors what those potential problems are, especially if you already have reason to believe they might materialize.
You've got a great analogy to illustrate this point, right? Help our listeners really grasp the difference between vague, generic warnings and those that are truly meaningful.
Absolutely. Imagine a company knows that one of its major manufacturing plants has just been hit by a devastating fire. They know it's going to disrupt production, cause delays, and likely hurt their bottom line. In that situation, a generic warning about potential market fluctuations or economic headwinds probably wouldn't pass muster as meaningful cautionary language. It's too broad, too disconnected from the specific problem at hand. They need to be upfront about the fire, about the anticipated disruptions, and about how it might impact their financial performance.
Right. The warning has to have a clear connection to the known risk. If your house is on fire, a general warning about the possibility of rain isn't going to be very helpful, is it? So going back to Asher v. Baxter, what was it about Baxter's cautionary statements that made the Seventh Circuit think that the district court might have been too quick to dismiss the case? Why did they send it back down for further review?
The Seventh Circuit was primarily concerned that the district court had accepted Baxter's warnings at face value without really digging into whether those warnings actually addressed the specific problems that the investors were alleging Baxter knew about at the time. Judge Easterbrook, who wrote the opinion for the Seventh Circuit, felt that it was premature to just assume that Baxter's warnings were good enough without a more thorough investigation into what Baxter actually knew and when they knew it.
Okay, so Judge Easterbrook and the Seventh Circuit were saying, let's pump the brakes a bit. We need more information before we can decide whether Baxter's safe harbor defense holds water. And what were some of the specific red flags that Judge Easterbrook highlighted in his opinion? What aspects of Baxter's disclosures did he find problematic?
A few things really stood out to the court. They felt that Baxter's warnings were pretty generic and static. They didn't really evolve or become more specific over time, even though, according to the investors, the problems within those key divisions, like renal and biosciences, were supposedly becoming more and more apparent internally.
So the lack of specific details, the fact that the warnings didn't seem to reflect these evolving risks that Baxter was allegedly aware of, that raised a big red flag for the court.
Absolutely. Judge Easterbrook was skeptical. He even questioned whether the general risks that Baxter was mentioning were actually the ones that were most likely to throw off their projections. He famously said, "No reason to think the listed risks were the important ones at the time." And then he went on to ask a really thought-provoking question. The statutory requirement of meaningful cautionary statements is not itself meaningful. What must the firm say?
That's a great quote. It really highlights the challenge of interpreting this legal standard. Meaningful. But what does that actually mean in practice? Judge Easterbrook also used a really clever analogy, in his opinion, to drive home this point about the inadequacy of vague warnings, right? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, he compared it to a weather forecast that simply says, might rain, when there's actually a hurricane bearing down on the coast. A general low-level warning about the possibility of some rain doesn't really prepare anyone for a major weather event that's highly likely to occur. Similarly, Baxter's general warnings about economic conditions and competition might not have adequately informed investors about those specific problems that were supposedly brewing within their own business divisions. They weren't telling investors about the hurricane that was about to hit their financial performance.
I love that analogy. It really paints a clear picture. Okay, so based on all of this, what was the specific test that the Seventh Circuit applied in deciding to send the case back down to the lower court? What criteria were they using to determine whether Baxter's safe harbor defense should hold up?
The central question, as articulated by the Seventh Circuit, was whether Baxter's cautionary statements actually identified the principal risks that were known to the company at the time they made those optimistic projections. They weren't saying Baxter had to be Nostradamus and predict the future perfectly, but they were emphasizing the need for those warnings to address the specific material risks that the company was already aware of.
And the fact that Baxter seemed to be reusing the same general warnings over and over again without adapting them to address those alleged internal problems, that really didn't help their case, did it?
Not at all. The Seventh Circuit felt that the consistent use of those same broad warnings, without any apparent effort to update them or make them more specific as those internal red flags were supposedly popping up, suggested that those warnings might not have been genuinely meaningful in light of the information that Baxter had at the time.
Okay, so there's a big lesson here for our listeners, especially those of you who are aspiring lawyers. What's the practical takeaway from this case? What should you keep in mind as you move forward in your legal careers?
The big takeaway is that specificity and timeliness are absolutely crucial when it comes to risk disclosures. If you're representing a company, you can't just rely on those old generic warnings and expect them to automatically shield your client from liability. You need to be diligent about regularly reviewing and updating those risk disclosures, probably on a quarterly basis, to make sure they accurately reflect the current and evolving risks that the company is facing. And when you're drafting those warnings, avoid vague boilerplate language. Instead, provide concrete examples of the potential negative impacts that those risks could have on the company's financial performance.
You mentioned earlier a hypothetical example of what more compliant language might have looked like in Baxter's case. Can you walk us through that again?
Sure. Instead of just saying something general like challenges in our operating divisions, Baxter could have been much more specific. They could have said something like, our renal division is experiencing higher than expected failure rates in a key product line, which we anticipate could reduce our revenue by 5 to 10% in the second half of the year. Or, regarding those plant closures, they could have said, the closure of our Plant X manufacturing facility is facing unexpected delays and cost overruns, which we now project will decrease our operational cash flow for the year by at least $30 million. Or they could have said, our renal division faces supply chain disruptions from Plant X closure, which could reduce revenue by 15%. The point is to be transparent about the specific problem and its potential financial impact. That's what makes the warning truly meaningful and gives it some teeth under the safe harbor provision.
I think that example really illustrates the difference. It's night and day in terms of the level of detail and specificity.
Okay, so what are the broader implications of the Seventh Circuit's ruling in Asher v. Baxter? What does it mean for companies that are making forward-looking statements? And what does it mean for investors who are relying on those statements?
For companies, the message is pretty clear. The safe harbor isn't a free pass. It's not a license to issue vague or outdated warnings. They have a responsibility to do their due diligence, to identify and clearly disclose the specific risks that they're aware of when they're making projections. If they failed to do that, they could be leaving themselves open to legal challenges, even if they've included some generic cautionary language in their disclosures.
And what about from the investor's perspective? How does this ruling impact them?
For investors, the Asher decision is a bit of a victory. It shows that the courts are willing to scrutinize those cautionary statements and hold companies accountable if those warnings aren't truly meaningful and tailored to the specific risks at hand. It gives investors more ammunition when they're arguing that they were misled by overly optimistic projections. It also helps level the playing field a bit because it forces companies to be more transparent about the potential downsides, not just the sunny upside.
It really underscores that ongoing tension in securities law, doesn't it? That balance between encouraging companies to be optimistic and forward-looking while also protecting investors from being misled.
Exactly. And Judge Easterbrook, in his opinion, put it perfectly. The harbor isn't safe if courts rubber stamp boilerplate. The courts have a crucial role to play in making sure that the safe harbor is being used for its intended purpose to encourage meaningful disclosure, not to shield companies that are trying to hide behind vague warnings.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Asher v. Baxter, what's the one big takeaway that you want our listeners to remember?
The key takeaway is this. When companies make predictions about the future, those predictions have to be accompanied by clear, specific warnings about the things that could go wrong, especially the things that the company already has reason to believe might go wrong. Generic, boilerplate warnings aren't enough. The warnings have to be tailored to the situation, and they have to be updated as the situation changes.
And it's important to remember that the Seventh Circuit's ruling in Asher v. Baxter didn't mean that Baxter automatically lost the case. It just meant that the case would continue, and that Baxter would have to defend its disclosures more thoroughly.
That's right. The Seventh Circuit sent the case back to the district court for further proceedings, which would likely have involved discovery, where both sides would have had to exchange evidence and information. Baxter still had the opportunity to argue that their warnings were adequate or that they weren't actually aware of the specific risks that the investors were alleging. The Seventh Circuit's decision simply meant that it was too early to dismiss the case outright based on the safe harbor provision.
So, as you continue your journey through law school and your legal careers, keep this in mind. In a world that's saturated with corporate forecasts and projections, sometimes the most important information is what's not being said. The devil is often in the details that are omitted, in the shadows that lurk behind those sunny projections. And that raises an important question for all of us. What responsibility do companies have to be truly transparent, to shine a light on the potential downsides, even when they're trying to paint a positive picture of the future? Food for thought, right?
Absolutely. Asher v. Baxter is a great case to really make you think about those issues, those ethical and practical dilemmas that lie at the heart of securities law.
And if you're interested in learning more, I highly recommend checking out Judge Easterbrook's full opinion in this case. It's known for being really well written and insightful.
It's a classic, and it provides some really valuable insights into how the courts grapple with these complex questions in securities litigation.
All right, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time for another deep dive.
See you then.